Welcome to A Worldview Apart, a podcast about the power of perspective in the 21st century. I'm your host, Eric Garza. Thanks for listening. This episode was inspired by a workshop that I participated in earlier this year called Parallel Narratives. The workshop was offered through a venue in Burlington, Vermont called the Rail Yard Apothecary, and it was a workshop I had the privilege of attending in person. And parallel narratives are basically kind of fictional or fantastical stories that we craft that are patterned after our life story or are patterned after some section of our life story. And my guests and I will talk about all of this in much greater detail, but the workshop basically entailed us, telling our life narrative, a shortened 10-minute version of our life narrative. And then from there, we embarked on a journey of turning that, you know, factual life narrative into something of a fantastical story that allowed us, or at least it allowed me, to really probe my understanding of my own life story in a lot greater depth than I have in the past. So this episode is going to explore this idea of parallel narratives and also explore the idea of storytelling and why it is so powerful more generally. My guests for today are the two women who facilitated the workshop called Parallel Narratives. I will allow the two of them to introduce themselves once we get going. So with that, I think I will go ahead and cue up my conversation with Trish Denton and Pamela Formica. I do hope you enjoy it. So to get us started, the two of you, Pamela and Trish, could go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Sure. Thanks for having us, Eric. My name is Trish Denton, and I'm the principal artist of In Tandem Arts. I'm a theater maker and a storyteller based in Burlington, Vermont.
Cool. My name's Pamela Formica. I'm a mental health counselor and substance abuse counselor in private practice in Burlington, Vermont. I also am co-founder of Small Potatoes Theater Company, where I direct and write plays, perform.
Cool. And I know the two of you because you put together a workshop that was held at Rail Yard Apothecary earlier this year called Parallel Narratives. And so I thought a great way to start our conversation this evening would be for the two of you to talk about, what compelled you to put that workshop together?
Sure. So for the past few years, I've been researching and producing projects that combine storytelling, performance, and folk narratives. And I've been sort of coming at storytelling from this angle of mixing genres in order to shed light on things that are difficult to get at when you are confined by the conventions of a discipline. In that, I was sort of seeking some mentorship on going a little bit deeper with my storytelling practice. Have a lot of experience as a director in theater and working in text-based work, but have always sort of naturally gravitated toward oral storytelling and really wanted to work with someone who had more expertise in that area. And so fortunately, I was able to connect through a fellow professor. An advisor that I had at Dartmouth is actually the chair of the folklore program at UPenn, and he has been in that chair for a very, very, very long time, and his name is Dan Benemis. He had a student in the early 90s who graduated from the UPenn folklore program, who is now living in Chennai, India, and operates an organization called the World Storytelling Institute. And it's a two-person operation. It's Eric Miller and his wife, and she does psychodrama. She's a psychodrama practitioner, and he is a folklorist come psychotherapist. And so they operate the World Storytelling Institute together. Perfect connection of we both have this interest in history and folklore, but want to move toward using it in more therapeutic ways. So I took this course last fall, and a lot of the methodology that I used in parallel narratives was informed by my work with Eric Miller, informed by a lot of other things as well. But really the inspiration came when I approached Pamela with my idea to sort of use my expertise in the performing arts in a way that was to promote self-development in the community, and to use this this training that I did at the World Storytelling Institute, not just to do a private service or a artistic project, but to start some public programming with those principles.
Yeah, and when Trish and I go way back in the performance world, where we've performed in a play that she created and some cabaret, and we've been characters on stage. And when she came to me with this idea, I just was really fascinated by it. As a therapist, it's all storytelling. I mean, people come in and they have their stories, and there's, from doing this work, what I have found is that it's in those spaces of possibility is where people make change. And when Trish was told me about this workshop, and I was, you know, really got me thinking about how, you know, the way in which theater and improv and therapy, how they all relate to each other. And this idea of doing a workshop that wasn't, you know, this wasn't about people coming to do therapy, but this self-development in a way that is not about analyzing a problem or coming in to say, well, something needs to be changed or fixed. As a therapist, I find that those things don't work anyway. You know, everything serves a function. Everything people does, symptoms, these things serve a function. And to get a group together and to look at, well, what are your stories and where else are there stories that are similar to this? And that process that happens when you hear a story that you relate to, or maybe somebody else relates to a story that you have. And it just seemed like a very profound way to work with a group of people, you know, utilizing things that we know from the therapy world and things that we know from the theater world and storytelling, and put it together in a way in which people can have this work of art when they're done. And I've actually used elements of this now in my practice. And it's really wonderful because people are coming in and it's not just about, well, you're coming in, we're focusing on fixing a problem or changing something. It's also that they're leaving with, you know, they're leaving with a piece of art they created. And that's the focus. I mean, when that's the focus of therapy, things are changing, but it's not sometimes to get your mind off of that, to get your mind off of, oh, there's a problem that we're fixing. Instead, it's like, while we're in this process, we're forgetting that this even has to do with anxiety or depression. It's just, you know, moving through and having this really amazing story at the end of it. So so that is how it all started, and it's been really a great process.
Yeah, I feel like I really wanted to have Pamela on board to sort of help with some things that we've identified in the past in theater, which is the storming of the director. And I didn't want this dynamic of just that I'm the boss, I'm the leader, I'm the teacher, I'm the artist, and you are the seekers, but to really have the two of us coming multi-directionally at this as, yeah, there's many different ways that any of us can enter into or access our own creative process. And there's a lot of movement in that. So we're really moving through something instead of, as you put it, you know, coming at it with a pickaxe to chip it away or a road at it or something. Yeah, yeah. It's more like you're working with it, working with each other, and doing that in a way that's very much through the creativity.
Yeah, and not knowing what's going to happen next, which the process everybody in the group was experiencing of what will happen with this story. I think we were having that same process of, well, we might go here or there. Or there's this story, or how will this go? So being in that place of possibility, I think was really felt in doing this.
Yeah, this group. I remember when I first saw the advertisement for the workshop. I read through it, and I was attracted to the idea of storytelling and telling, you know, my own personal story, or kind of like investigating that in various ways, you know, maybe even a lot like I would if I were sitting down in a chair with working with a therapist. And I've always been interested in telling nonfiction stories. Mm-hmm. And so when I saw the workshop and I saw that it was going to be weaving in like folklore and mythology, I'm like, I don't know if this is exactly something that I want. But I decided to do it anyway because, like, at the very least, I'll learn something about storytelling. And so I was really shocked as I went through the workshop at how powerful it was for me. You know, we started, you know, telling our, you know, a short version of our life narratives, and then kind of crafted those into these parallel narratives, which were, you know, fantastical and fictional, and I mean, not even fictional. I mean, they're based on you know, my own life story, but they're, you know, we adjusted them so that they're fantastical in various ways. Yeah. And I was really surprised at how therapeutic that was.
Yeah.
And that kind of leads me to a question, you know, and I suspect a lot of my listeners are very familiar with the idea of folk tales and folk narratives, but until I came to this class, I was not. I mean, it was this thing that I probably read some of when I was young or in high school or at various points in my education, but it's not something I'd ever really studied. So I guess a question I wanted to toss out there is, like, what is a folk narrative, and why were those so powerful?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's folk is a very contested term, especially nowadays, and I mentioned Dan Benemis, and a lot of the folklore programs in academia are becoming cultural ethnography, or are getting absorbed into cultural anthropology, and it's hard to define what it is now. But my definition of a folk narrative is, it's a narrative, an imaginative attempt to problem solve that comes from an oppressed people. And often that is featuring a lot of elements that may seem fantastical to us, but actually were very much a part of the cultural norms from the time periods when these tales were shared most widely. For instance, castles and knights and princesses and nobility might seem like something that's very distant to us, whereas when these tales were widely distributed orally in Europe, that was the norm. There were no nations. It was all kingdoms, and the majority of people who were the folk, the commoners, the working class, they were experiencing abject poverty. The conditions involved a lot of hard labor, and sort of their dreams and their rally cries and their resistance against those conditions were to tell stories where they're overthrowing the king, or where they become queen, or what have you. And so a lot of folklorists look at folk narratives to be based more in truth than in fiction. And others are coming at it seeing the material as more mythical. When we get into the area that Pamela and I have been playing with in parallel narratives, it's more the kind of psychological and symbolic realm of interpreting these tales. And so this is less of the social science of a folklore, of the approach a folklorist would take, and more so of a social psychologist or a psychologist. So Marie Louise von Franz, who is a contemporary of Jung, she really read into fairy tales, which are a subgenre of folk tales, of folk narratives, as housing so many cultural practices and artifacts and I don't want to say symbolism, but so many different indicators of what the social currents were of the time. And so there's a lot of different directions in which to work with this material. And I think that's what makes it so powerful, is because they're so versatile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's also, I think when with this class, we were also looking at, there's some common themes that come up in journeys. You know, there's, when you think about Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey. Yeah. And there's, you know, in all of the stories, even before, when people told their raw story, and we would go through and look for turning points, and you're looking for, you know, I think a Mr. Rogers saying, when something happens and there's a tragedy, look for the helpers. You know, there's always helpers. So you're looking for the helpers. You're looking for the turning points. You're looking for those metaphors that people naturally use when they're telling their stories, so that when we started out with those raw stories, people already had the elements of myth and of folklore almost in the story. And then as you're then taking those elements out and playing with them and combining them with ancient or old stories, then it becomes something. Not necessarily. I like what Trish had said. You had said at one point, when it feels satisfying, you're recreating and you're feeling that sense of satisfaction when you're taking your story and creating distance as the narrator. So when you're the narrator, now you've got a little bit of distance. And from the narrator's point of view, you can now see possibility, where when you're telling the same story over and over again, I think what makes it powerful psychologically is, we know now from neuroscience, you know, neurons that wire together, fire together, you know, or that fire together, wire together. That's the way they say it. And so that, you know, so people tell their story the same way over and over. And you know, because when people do that, it becomes not so interesting. Like if you say the same thing and you hear the same thing, you can notice that you become almost in this trance state. You're going over the same thing over and over. And the beauty of something like taking your story and now seeing a new possibility is it becomes interesting. Mm-hmm. And you have more autonomy because you have space from it. It also, I think, bypasses when you're talking to somebody and you're struggling with a problem. I think the psyche is just automatically will resist when somebody tries to give you advice and the answer, you know? So stories bypass that. If you hear a story that's similar to what you went through, but there's a shift, you've bypassed that natural resistance we have as autonomous beings to not want somebody to control and take over our story. So those are a few things that I could see happening in the group as people were, you know, and people were like, wait a minute, that's not my story. Like, we had some suggestions on stories, and people would suggest stories or say, hey, your narrative looks like, and people would be like, oh yeah, that's true. Oh no, that no, you know, and it's okay to reject a story. Feels very different than having to have somebody attack, or, you know, it could feel like attack, somebody trying to change your story or try to get you to look at something.
I love that sort of the dichotomy between the static, repetitive, version of the story versus the live and dynamic framework of a story. And that's definitely another prong to your question of what is folk and what are folk narratives. These stories were told by a pre-literate society, and so they were recited. It was recitation, and they were so flexible in being handed around from place to place. And you can see all of these like beautiful micro variations and then some drastic variations across the entire continent of Europe and through Russia, of just so many myriad different ways in which people shared the tales and put a little bit of the colloquialisms from their area the food and specialties in their region, or just personal stylizings of the teller himself or herself. So it's, there's something so different about the way that we house stories now comes from we're used to words being this capsule and reading stories and having an owner. Whereas folk narratives were handed around and were very malleable, and they were a shared collective commons.
People are owning the stories versus being a spectator or having it be.
Absolutely. It wasn't the teller having the spotlight. It was very much a collective shared experience.
And I mentioned this word before, so I wonder if it's a good time for us to kind of talk about this in greater detail. You know, the term parallel narrative, you know, I had not heard of that term until I saw it as the title of the workshop, you know, that the two of you offered. So what is a parallel narrative, and where does that kind of terminology come from?
Trish, because you're the
Because I invented it. I'm not only a theater maker and a storyteller, I'm an inventor. So there's an existing term, parallel plot or parallel narrative or parallel story, that's in cinema and in literature. And it concerns a story structure where the writer includes two or more separate narratives that are linked together by a common character, event, or theme. And so I knew that that existed, but that wasn't really what I was going for. I really wanted to just figure out a pretty like literal translation of the concept that I had for this creative process that the course offers. So really, parallel narratives is not this particular methodology, but it's a concept for the creative process that's intended for free association and exploration. And so in that, I'll just sort of break it down. So I'm kind of thinking of parallel and these parallels as metaphor, and drawing these symbolic associations. So it's not really a word-for-word swap out or a translation. Like in many world languages, it's really difficult to find the particular word to describe an experience that you're having. So this is really meant to be kind of a looser process of exploration, of trying on different associations and different metaphors and things that may or may not relate, in order to just gain perspective on what might have become a static storyline that you have in your head.
Yeah, and it starts with, you know, someone telling their factual life story, what they believe to be their factual life story. And so you're kind of making something, creating something that is parallel to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that kind of brings me to the other part of that question. So parallel narratives, as the course title, is sort of, you know, exploring this concept of really be it rooted in Jungian dream work and mm-hmm. the surrealist movement of free association, and trying to just find a space to play mm-hmm. With the way in which we make meaning from our narratives. So that's the sort of concept of the course. But then we also have the parallel narrative, which is the artistic product, yeah. or if you yeah, will. Yeah. I don't want to call it a product, but it's the work of art, as Pamela called it earlier, the little gem or the gift of a tale that we craft to walk away with in the end. And so through this process of taking real lived experience, having your sort of life story around that, relating it, playing with a canon of different fantastical works, folk tales, myths, and trying different things on for size, and then walking away with something that's a transformed, creative parallel.
Yeah, I also love the word parallel because of what it does with time. Because when you're saying parallel narrative, people had these different stories, and it could be an ancient story or it can be modern story, and parallel, it got rid of time. So it didn't matter. All of these stories are happening at the exact same time, and your past story and your now story, it sort of eliminates that whole, just like the dream world, you know, you're eliminating, you know, and getting rid of this idea. So all of this stuff can be going on at the same time and shifting and changing. And so I appreciated that word also for that reason, mm-hmm. to have it be so like this transcends time and space, and you know, and then people's different experiences can be going on at the same time, which also helps because people's life stories, often what happens is that people, because children are imaginative, when you're a child you take in everything and you're suggestive, and so certain messages you take in, and now you're in a different place and space and time as an adult, and you're repeating that same thing, or that same thing is working through you, and people think that that becomes part of them, the way, you know, the way their body, you know, their eyes, their bodies, like this is now what you come from. But when you take away time with a parallel narrative, it opens up that you can change this story now, but also in your memory. Mm. You know, your memory now is different. Your memory of your past, there is no longer memory of the past. It's this is your story, and you have transformed your now, and you've transformed the past, which I think is the power of being in that kind of a storytelling, a creative process, is that you are no longer tethered to this past story.
Mm. Yeah, so in the same manner in which you're becoming sort of a manipulator of the linear nature of narrative, you're becoming this sort of temporal master,
time traveler.
And that was definitely not to be sci-fi, but I was thinking of parallel narratives sort of as this truth that we are living in mm-hmm. a parallel universe, mm-hmm. in that there's all of these ways in which we're sort of simultaneously having our experience on a few different planes, even though it's like sensed or lived in or embodied in this concrete sort of place. And that's getting out there a little far, but I love kind of thinking about, just in the same way that the folk narratives have all of these wonderful variations on them with still kind of the same elemental lesson or moral, that experiences can happen in that way too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you bring up, folk narratives again, and you know, when you define that, probably the first time that I've heard like a succinct definition of it. You mentioned that it was kind of a narrative that people created to solve problems, and those people who crafted those narratives were oftentimes oppressed people in various ways. Mm-hmm. And so that inspires me to wonder if this kind of like using those folk narratives or exploring those folk narratives makes it easier for people to maybe access aspects of themselves that are oppressed or have been oppressed in some way.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. And I think anything where we're projecting possibility in some type of utopian, I'm not even going to say ideal, but just projection of bettering our situation, that definitely comes into play. And that is why I really am attracted to folk narratives, is because of that utopian impulse. And the way that you worded your statement, it also makes me think of the work of Augusto Boal, who is the theater practitioner that developed Theater of the Oppressed. And initially, he was doing his work with folks who were experiencing extreme poverty and had very obvious limiting circumstances going on. And the more he began to deepen the work and start to lead workshops internationally and travel the world with it, he started seeing kind of similarities. And this is a controversial thing to say, but it's something that I think about a lot. That folks in first world nations have a lot of oppression, but it's more psychological. And he talks about how there's these sort of internalized, what he calls cops, a cop in the head,
that are
beating you down, keeping up with the Joneses, and all of the things that are first world problems are actually very oppressive to one's psyche. Whereas it's a little bit more difficult to solve because they're unseen. They're inside. Whereas folks who just have very obvious food insecurity or housing insecurity or opportunity, those things are visible and seen and therefore somehow feel more workable. A lot of Boal's work is sort of centered around this idea of unearthing oppressions.
Yep.
Yeah. I think that also speaks to this idea of people in parts, which, you know, theater and story really, really speaks to, where if you're telling your story and you have to be this one person experiencing it, it limits that perception, where when you're looking at a story and you've got all these different characters, and you could be all of these different characters because there are no, you know, everybody is multiple. Everybody has multiple parts, and it's the communication among the parts and the understanding of that multiplicity that creates wholeness and mental health. And that ability to do that with a story, it's a lot easier to navigate that when you think of a story and having all of these different characters that are you, and as the narrator having that space. That's a lot more, that's easier to manage than, you know, being in your house feeling bad that you have, your lawn isn't as nice. It's like, whatever.
Chem lawn isn't as green.
Yeah. And you may not recognize that this is your inner oppressor, because you are. You've they talk about in like internal family systems, you know, you've blended with your inner critic. You become that, and you don't realize that's not you, that's a part. So through that process of storytelling, that's one way to see, oh, I'm the narrator, so I can talk about, the critic can be a character in my story, but they're not running the show. And that's powerful.
Yes. And that's very much at the heart of the work of Paulo Freire and Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and identifying that you, he calls it housing the oppressor, that you internalize the oppressor's voice as your own, and you think that it's coming from you.
Yes.
And with Pedagogy of the Oppressed, he sort of believes that liberation comes from being the narrator and naming your reality in a way that is free of all of those superimposed superimposed narration. And so agency coming from narrating your own story is a big part of that educational philosophy.
What I like about it is different than, and you'll see this when somebody is feeling really bad about themselves, they don't, arguing with that part of them that's a critic never works. So if you're having like a regular conversation, you say, oh, you know, I feel bad, I'm this terrible. You know, people can argue, no, you're really a good person. No, I'm a terrible person. That argument can go on, and people do that with themselves, which the way you just describe that, you know, you're housing this oppressor. But when you become the narrator, you're not arguing with the oppressor, you know, like this is what people usually do. They argue with it and it doesn't go anywhere. Instead, it's like you're acknowledging that oppressor, and maybe you're having them go away. But who knows what maybe you're having a conversation. Maybe you're understanding the function of that, whatever that is so different than what often people do is they talk to others about how they feel bad about themselves, or they identify how they feel, and then they try to fight and argue with that. Mm-hmm. And it never works because it just keeps fighting back because you're engaging with it in that way, you know?
Yeah. I was thinking about that, of how, like, I have this narrative and I can take that inner critic and I can make that inner critic a character in the story.
Yeah.
I can have other people kind of arguing with that critic.
Or even ask it questions. Like, what function? Why do you serve?
It's like I can distance myself from that enough that I can like see that story play out for what it is, which is just this, you know, kind of story.
Maybe it's a sad monster that now just wants some friends
or attention or something
just
like
wants
that.
To tell, like, it doesn't, you know, because people, the fighting against it or the list or the blending with it and becoming that, you know, is where it seems like people can get stuck. We can all get stuck.
Mm-hmm. Eric, I like how you just made sort of a distinction between narrating and story. And it brings me back to sort of the question of why parallel narrative? And we talked about why parallel and how. Look at us go. And the narrative part, I tend to say folk narratives instead of folk tales, because I feel like that's more accurate. And I didn't make that up. I'm not alone in the folklore world around that. But I like narrative instead of parallel stories. Because story sort of implies that the teller has crafted a work of art that has a beginning, a middle, an end, and it very distinctly has the teller's voice, and it's constructed in some regard. Whereas a narrative is something that is narrated or reported in a manner that explains kind of the true account of the experience. So in that way, it's more raw material, and you're trying to relate something that you've experienced. And that's very appealing to me in the age of let's curate, you know, prepackage and create an Instagram story about every aspect of my life. And everything is with social media and just the nature of modern life. We don't allow ourselves to be sort of unfiltered and tell our account of things in a way that's just coming from our own inner eye.
Yeah, it's like everything about us is so overwhelmingly rehearsed. Mm-hmm. Like we have this idea of this sort of facade that we want to present to people, and we just hold to that to a T, and we just destroy ourselves if we don't, if we fail.
Yeah, and I think that that is, it brings up a lot of what we were talking about with class differences of presentation and relatability and the way in which people interact externally with those filters, filter upon filter upon filter. I think that really relates to what Boal was saying about having more of this internalized oppression of just you're erasing yourself and your authenticity through so many things that are helping you to, you know, keep in stride with society or whatever it may be, whatever the motivation is.
Those stories become like a lie you're living.
I mean, that was one of the things that that I was thinking about when as I was moving through this workshop. It was a 6-week workshop, so there was a good amount of time to kind of explore bits and pieces of this as we went along. And I noticed, you know, I've told my various bits and pieces of my life narrative to various people over the years. And one of the things that I noticed is that as I started kind of crafting this parallel narrative, turning my, you know, true life narrative, or true to the extent that I can recall things, and turning that into this kind of like somewhat fictionalized, somewhat fantastical sort of a tale, it was a lot easier for me to kind of acknowledge bits and pieces of what actually happened and to kind of talk about them. And it actually made it, crafting and telling the parallel narrative has actually made it easier for me to kind of dig in and really look at details of the actual narrative. And you know, as I was thinking about that, I've been thinking a lot about some of the, you know, like really big, powerful stories or narratives, if you want to call them that, that I remember from my life. You know, one of them, I actually did a podcast episode about this not too long ago on Daniel Quinn's book Ishmael, and how, because it was couched as fiction, it's like a novel that he wrote. About a telepathic gorilla that teaches a human being, you know, all kinds of things about the origins of civilization and why some things are not as well, you know, not as good as they could be. Because that whole story was couched in fiction, it was a lot easier for me to engage with it than it would have been if he had chosen to write like an anthropology book and said, you know, all this stuff about, you know, civilization and agriculture wasn't all it's cracked up to be, and all that kind of stuff. And so I wonder if that's like a big motivation for, or maybe that was a motivation for people to kind of weave stories of oppression into these folk tales, is that it made made reality a bit easier to bear and a bit easier to talk about.
Yes. I mean, I wasn't there, but
it's more palpable.
I think just from doing this work in contemporary settings with people, it definitely has an antidotal sort of properties to it, where it somehow feels like it's helping get the poison out somehow.
Well, and it also bypasses that resistance. I mean, Milton Erickson, who is a hypnotherapist of days gone by, he spent his childhood with dealing with illness and spent a lot of time alone and became a storyteller in his own right, you know, just telling. And when he would work with people, he's known for being pretty quirky, but he would tell these, it would be all in metaphor. And he would, you know, there's stories about him working with like a farmer who was healing from something, and he would talk about the seasons and the, you know, the growing of, you know, plants and that. And there's a story of him talking to somebody or working with somebody who's an alcoholic and using the metaphor of a cactus who doesn't need much water and they don't need to drink that often. You don't, you know, and so, they were able to hear, oh, the cactus that doesn't need to drink very often, doesn't need, you know, and that's able to get through because it's not a direct attack. Oh, what do you do? You know,
not
here's
confronting
the thing.
Someone's alcoholism.
So there's something about, and not to trick people. I mean, it's not about, you know, you want to be tricking people, but more when we hear a story, you can relax. It's just a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you can identify things that you relate to versus, and maybe the same thing with oppression. There's these horrible when, you know, horrible things in the world and you hear it straight on and, you know, people can't handle that. But when you hear it in a story and you can, you know, identify with that or experience the empathy through that, and it's not, doesn't feel like as much of an attack, I think that bypasses something that makes us, and maybe what makes us human, because we, you know, in being in that world of empathy, it's not about hearing hard facts. It's hard to access empathy when you're being attacked with facts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm reminded, I mean, just this earlier this year, they released the movie Black Panther. I don't know if either of you have seen that.
Oh, I haven't.
It's an incredible film and so deeply political on so many levels. I mean, it's basically a film that poses the question, you know, what would have happened if African nations had managed to avoid colonization? And in that way, mm-hmm. it directly confronts the realities of kind of the European colonial era on you know, people in the African continent. And I mean, this is a film, and I thought the tone of the film and the messaging of the film was extraordinarily blatant. I mean, they use metaphors certainly, but they were not hiding anything and they did not pull punches. And yet you still have this film becoming this uber mega blockbuster, like breaking all these records. And it's just amazing to me to see that happening in 21st century America with Donald Trump in office and white supremacy having this huge insurgence.
Yeah.
And there's a part of me that's like, how can this be? I mean, this is like two different worlds like operating at the same time. But at the same time, it makes sense because, you know, the Black Panther is attacking all these things in the realm of fiction where people mm-hmm. feel safer.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, my hope is that it leads to conversations that people can draw outside of that realm of fiction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, agreed. And I mean, listening to the two of you talk, I can't help but focus on that word of bypass, and or bypass something by using metaphor, and it makes me think of the highway or the freeway. And then I start thinking of the express lane and how maybe it's our just innate nature to crave vocabulary in a visual language, in a conceptual, metaphorical, symbolic, imaginative language. And so it's not bypassing something, but it's an express route into this thing that's so hungry that we have that's not being fed because we're so inundated by all of this information all the time in the information age. The age of information? I don't know. Yep. The digital age.
Yeah. Yeah. And that oral part of it has been really intriguing to me. I mean, I've you know, I'm a college instructor, so I'm accustomed to getting up in front of people and presenting facts, you know, for an hour and 15 minutes or however long, you know, my classes end up being. But getting up in front of people, even if it's just like 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and telling a story, oftentimes one that I've never actually written down, is just such an extraordinarily different experience.
Yeah, than telling facts.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah. It is. And I feel like not only am I able to connect with people in the audience in a fundamentally different way and in a deeper way, but I feel like in telling that story, I'm connecting to some part of myself in a deeper mm-hmm. way than if I were to mm-hmm. just get up there and like recite facts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember that feeling from, you know, the final day of the workshop where we actually told, you know, maybe not our finished parallel narratives, but, you know, where they had gotten to, you know, over the course of the 6-week workshop. And I felt more connected to my life narrative after telling that, you know, kind of fantastical parallel narrative than I'd ever felt, you know, having told, you know, talked to people, you know, for hours sometimes about mm-hmm. different parts of my life and helping me kind of like work through things. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was just, yeah, I'm still kind of flabbergasted at how powerful that ended up being.
It was powerful. The room, as people were telling their stories, you can feel how everything, everyone was in this shared trance state, mm-hmm. you know, telling their stories and connecting to the feelings and the images. I mean, it's a whole body experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an embodied experience versus when you're just dealing with facts.
Yeah. I can imagine, you know, like 14th century England, you know, peasants sitting around a fire or a hearth, you know, talking, you know, telling a folk narrative and having that same sense of connection with each other as they figured out how in the world are they going to make a living in that region for another year.
Yeah. What's kind of cool to bring in some science into this is they've done studies on imagination and the difference between imagining doing an activity and actually doing it. So there's this one study where they had people imagine playing the piano, and they only imagined it. They didn't actually practice on a piano. Then they had another group who practiced playing the same, you know, whatever, the same pattern, and then they had them actually play the piano, and they progressed the same amount. They progressed the same as, so if you imagine yourself doing something and it's a full-bodied experience, your brain and your mind and your memory experiences it the same as if you've done it, which is fascinating when you think about it. So you can, and it's what people do all the time. You know, people in sports, they imagine themselves, you know, playing the sport. People, you probably have done this, Trish, when you're about to perform a play. I know I go through all the lines and I imagine myself being fantastic and, you know, and they're doing it. And, you know, you just imagine, and you have that and you start to feel that in your body. And when you're going through it, you are doing it. And so I think when people tell stories, and it was that day everyone told their story, it was very profound. You can feel everybody was feeling that and in that story, and people were in it with you. When you were talking about being in the woods and, you know, what you were encountering. I mean, I could feel myself being in the woods and encountering that, all of that with you and holding the rocks. And, you know, it's just incredibly, I think it's not only, it's profound, and it is like what you were saying, Trish, communal. You know, you're sharing that everyone is in that story with you. So you are not alone in whatever story you're telling.
Yes. And in this case, in parallel narratives, there is an aspect of self-development. And so I think the stories that we were telling weren't just for entertainment's sake.
Yeah.
I sat in that chair and the hair was raised on the back of my neck and I had like hot tears right behind my eyes kind of the whole time. And I felt moved is not the right word, but I felt stimulated and like entered into sort of somebody else's sphere in a way that really doesn't happen for me in my regular everyday life.
Yeah. We all entered each other. You all had this experience together, went to all these different places.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a friend of mine. He lives out in California, but he travels to, I think it's Botswana, usually every March. He probably just got back recently to spend about a month with San Bushman. He's big into animal tracking and other like nature-y skills. And so he goes out there to spend a month with the San Bushman and usually leads a group of people out there as part of like an immersion experience. And one of the things that he... one of the stories he comes back with is that he will kind of recount how, you know, this is a non-literate group of people and how important storytelling is for them to kind of perpetuate their culture, but also to pass on incredibly useful skills. You know, they will go out hunting during the day and maybe they'll be successful or maybe they won't. And then they'll come back and the people who went hunting will, you know, kind of perform their hunt around the fire, you know, like crafting this semi-fictional, certainly embellished tale of what happened. And as they do that, they're imparting all kinds of information to young people who are around the fire about tracking animals and strategy as you're trying to approach, I don't know the names of a lot of the big animals, but like a kudu, for example, is like a large antelope-like animal. You know, the strategy that you have to use as you, you know, try to close the distance on the kudu so you can get a shot with your bow and arrow. And I feel like it's much the same thing. You know, it has a as a goal that storytelling has is there for personal development, you know, not just for the people who are telling it, but also for all the people who are there who might grow up one day, you know, to be one of the hunters who is expected to go out and you know, make meat for that tribe.
Absolutely.
And it's like dressed up as this performance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that really strikes a chord for me because in my other life as a children's theater director, I also go into schools and I use the performing arts and storytelling in various mediums to teach some type of curriculum through the art form. And so it's this pedagogical application of some type of useful information that needs to be handed on, but it's packaged in this way that's very interactive and, come on, let me just say it, fun. And I didn't want to say it earlier, but I was thinking it. I was like, come on, doing the parallel narratives was kind of fun.
Yeah.
Well, and you also, Trish, had, you know, part of the parallel narratives was also Trish's, what you do with sculpting bodies. So what would you call it?
Tableau. Or sculpting.
And yeah, like that seemed like that was such a big part of it. So people were embodying stories before they were telling the stories, which is...
Yeah, that was fun. I did not expect to do anything like that, but that was a lot of fun.
It was wild watching what people came up with, too. It was, like, amazing. Just how people were embodying these with no words, you know, and just having the, you know, I guess you can just probably describe it better, what that is.
Yeah. So there's kind of three different schools of thought that I combined to sort of create the structure of the course. And a big part of my formal training and my background is with a French theater maker named Emmanuelle Delpech. And she trained at the Jacques Lecoq International Theater School in Paris. And a lot of the folks that I work with in New York have all trained at that school. And Lecoq was an activist who was disturbed by what he saw happening during World War II. And he used pantomime and gymnastics and bodies, essentially, to tell stories in a time where it was dangerous to use words. And so that is... a huge part of my work is influenced by Jacques Lecoq. And the way that I sort of scaffolded the learning for the workshop is I first wanted us to just be engaging with our bodies and with each other in a way where we weren't working so much with the words because... not to sound anti-literacy or something, because I'm not at all. I'm a complete book nerd. But I think we get quite a lot of that in our adult lives now in the way that we experience learning. And so doing more of this pantomime and frieze tableaus and physical theater, just to start looking at kind of pictures and having, you know, the most pared down of materials and resources available to us to somehow create a story seemed like a great place to start. Yeah. Getting to know each other, getting into our bodies, feeling embodied in... immersing in the genre of tales that we were digging into to prepare us to open up to the way in which we were going to work beyond that. So Lecoq was sort of the initial influences that we were working with.
And then I started getting a little more into, I had mentioned Freire earlier, into some exercises that are from critical pedagogy and pedagogy of the oppressed. And those were all elements of creative workshops that I have done in correctional facilities and rehabilitation facilities, using ethnography, personal testimony, theater, and storytelling in those institutional settings through a program called Telling My Story, which operates out of White River Junction in Vermont. And it's an organization, but it's also a program that's based out of Dartmouth College. And so I was a graduate teaching assistant with that program for 3 years, and I worked in correctional facilities and rehab facilities, going in and using very similar techniques, such as the talking circle that we used, where, which is very closely related to talking stick in Native American practices, and making associations between different common themes that we discovered, and really trying to equalize as a group and as an ensemble with our thoughts and our words was sort of the next phase after sort of equalizing and getting comfortable and getting in touch more with our physical bodies in the space. And then lastly, I sort of got into more of the wordsmithing and the story crafting and just imagination. And yes, there were some trance and hypnosis things sort of peppered through there too that I'd like you to maybe speak about. But with the final exercises for Imagineering, that's all based on a Italian author who was really instrumental in educational reform in Italy. And I don't know if you've heard of Reggio Emilia. It's an Italian educational philosophy. He was kind of one of the founders of that. His name is Johnny Rodari. And he wrote this like zany, it's so manic and wonderful. Like, I love, it's poetic, it's passionate, it's zany. It's basically a diary of all the different exercises that he used for creative story crafting with kids, with adults, his own techniques for getting his imaginative juices flowing. And that is called The Grammar of Fantasy. And it was brought to the States and translated by Jack Sipes. So we have an English translation, which is wonderful. And Johnny Rodari has been very much an influence on sort of the way that I've started working in the schools with kids to collectively construct what I consider tales that are a continuation of the folk genre. Pamela, did you want to say something about your hypnosis exercises that we did too? Because I feel like that was a really solid part of the course as well.
Well, I mean, I think that the whole, we did a little bit of, you know, trance. I think we, you know, being, you know, some exercises and just journaling from a mindful place and people really focusing and listening to each other. I did do the one exercise, and we just did one, and I'm cautious with the word hypnosis, has so many connotations, and hypnosis is really just trance states, altered states, different states with suggestion. And we did do one exercise taken from Stephen Gilligan, who he works out of San Diego, California. He has something called Trance Camp that he does every year. And I had gone to an Ericksonian training where he did work on different ways of, instead of trying to get people in a certain state, it's everyone goes in and out of trance all the time. So when you're driving, you're in trance, you know, you're not thinking about everything you're doing. When you're telling a story, that's often a trance state. It's basically being in the flow state, being in that, what we've been talking about, that non-rational, you know, where you're flowing, you're in this state, and that's where imagination lives. And so the energy, we did a little work with energy. The energy ball is being able to feel energy, having the suggestion and feeling energy between your hands, and then making suggestions around that energy, feeling it as heat, feeling it as this actual energy. And you can begin to feel it when you do this exercise. And then setting intentions, when the three intentions that he talks about that are ideal for possibility and change are curiosity. You know, when you're able to be in a curious state and you wonder what's going to come next, you don't know. positive fierceness, which I really like, having positive fierceness, which takes care of often everyone has inner protectors. So when I don't even really believe in resistance, and nobody's resistant to be resistant, we have protectors. And so positive fierceness is that energy of your fire, that you can be fierce in this positive way. And that's protective, but it doesn't block creativity. It's more like fire going outward. And playfulness, you know, which is, you know, just being able to play with something, being able to have something not work and then do something else. So when he talks about these, he talks about generative trance, and he has a book called Generative Trance, and how we can utilize trance states and be in the flow to create these generative possibilities for change. And it is fun, and it's about, and it's what, you know, what people do in theater, and it's what, you know, it's what children do naturally. Children are not like, now I'm doing something creative. You know, they play house or whatever. You know, they're not, they just do it. They're always in generative trance. And then we lose that as we become more, as we age, and ways in which we can get back into those states, which I think the whole idea of creating a parallel narrative and playing with your story is being in that generative trance state.
Yeah, it's been a great conversation. Do either of you have any final thoughts you'd like to offer before we wrap up?
Well, Trish is offering another workshop. Do you want to talk about your upcoming workshop?
Sure. So Pamela definitely was very instrumental in being a sounding board and a wonderful co-conspirator in developing the workshop. And now I'm going to sort of fly solo and start offering it regularly, as well as I'm doing some more private sessions with people. And some people have approached me about training them to run a similar course in their town. So next step is to launch another 6-week round at the Rail Yard Apothecary in Burlington. And similar setup, what we do is start with everyone in the group telling a 10-minute version of their life story, of their life narrative. And then we, through sharing and making associations, we pool together different ideas of popular materials, folklore, myths, fairy tales, things that seem relevant to the person's tale. And at the end, you will go through the process having explored many different approaches and perspectives on sort of reevaluating your life narrative to create a creative work that's a transformed story of that narrative. So there's a lot of game playing. There are all the exercises that we discussed in this conversation are sort of scaffolded mindfully to help people work towards being prepared to undergo the process of creating their oral tale, their parallel narrative, in a way that very much feels like it's theirs, but to be shared.
Yep. Do you have anything?
I hope people sign up for the class. It's really, I get to actually be one of Trisha's going to work with me now. So I get to do my parallel narrative.
Oh, wow.
I'm very excited about that. And and thank you so much for having us here.
Yeah. And do either of you have like web presences or social media presences you'd like to let people know about?
Yes. So you can visit my website, which is www.intandemarts.com, intandemarts.com. Lots of things about educational reform, critical pedagogy, community events, and socially engaged art, programming that mixes radical politics and self-development and all that good stuff.
One thing I'd like for people in Burlington that are interested, the Off Center for the Dramatic Arts, I'm on the board of that, and we're really trying to expand out, have more people be involved in that. There's storytelling, there's experimental theater going on there. So, and I am not remembering the website off the top of my head, but if you Google the Off Center for the Dramatic Arts, you might want to check out what's going on there if you're interested in theater and storytelling.
Cool. Well, thank you, both of you, very much for joining me this evening.
Thank you so much, Eric.
So that is all for this episode of Worldview Apart. I want to thank Trish Denton and Pamela Formica for joining me on the podcast. If you have an interest in following up on any of the resources that were mentioned during this episode, easiest way for you to track all those down would be by visiting my website. Each episode of this podcast has its own page, and each page has its own links and resources section. So you can head over to ericgarza.info, go to podcast in the main menu, and page down to this episode, which is episode number 72. And then you can find a list of links and resources that were mentioned in the podcast there, as well as a few other things that either I or Trish or Pamela suggested that we add. A few other things I want to ask for. First of all, if you enjoyed this episode or others you've listened to in this podcast, reviews are always appreciated. You know, positive reviews in particular help my podcast rise in search rankings and make it easier for folks to find me. And while you are, on iTunes or whatever other app you use to listen, you can also subscribe so you don't miss any content. I'm always grateful when folks share individual episodes of this podcast or the podcast more generally. You can share on email, you can do that on social media, or of course you can do that by word of mouth as well. And last but not least, before I sign off for this episode, I want to send some gratitude out to the Montreal-based band Crowfoot for letting me use their tune, G'day Miss Iris, to start this episode. The tune was written by Adam Broom, and it was performed by Adam, J.H. Trudell, and Nicholas Williams. You can learn more about this band and their music at their website, which is crowfootmusic.com. So that is all. Thank you for your listenership, and I do hope you enjoyed this episode. Until next time, this is Eric Garza, your humble host of A Worldview Apart, signing off. Take care, and I will talk to you again soon.